Welcome to Living with Dying, a podcast where we're going to talk about the unspeakable, everything to do with death and dying, and how to live with it. We're all on the same journey towards the end, but we just never talk about it. We don't like to think of our own life ending, and we certainly don't like to contemplate losing our nearest and dearest. So we all join in this huge conspiracy, pretending it won't happen to us. And then, when it does, we're often ill-prepared. So we're saying, let's talk about death. Let's open up the subject, and by listening to other people's stories, glean some advice and tips on how best to approach death, how to deal with loss, and how to rebuild a life after. So I'm very pleased today to be joined by Rabbi Jonathan Romaine, who's going to talk to us about his grief after the loss of his son. And I have interviewed a mother who lost a son, Jonathan, and I remember saying at that time, I couldn't put myself in her shoes. I couldn't begin to think what it must feel like. I wonder if you'd tell me a bit about your son first, perhaps, and then we can talk about what happened and how he died.
Well, Benedict was a lovely chap, and I'm not saying that not just because I'm a biased dad, because he actually really, really was. And at the funeral we had 200 friends. I mean, most of my other sons, who are also lovely, don't have that many friends. He was really, really liked and well-respected. He was a very talented young man, a sculptor, but he was great fun and he was sporty and he was adventurous. But the thing that really made people like him was he was kind. And he was a fashion centre, a fashion leader, in all sorts of different ways, but he always had time for everybody else. It was never about him, it was always about other people. And so many people said that even though he was only 34, that he'd helped them or mentored them or been there for him. And that was his abiding characteristic. So nice chap. And of course, he was 34, which is pretty young. And sadly, it was on his honeymoon that he drowned. So there's an added poignancy to that. So I have to say, of course, although it was terrible for my wife and myself because we'd lost a son who we adored, you know, actually it was much worse for his wife because she'd lost the partner she was going to share the rest of her life with.
And so, on honeymoon, I mean.
Yes, exactly.
Tragic, I mean,
I was about to say it can't get any worse, but it can. But it was pretty bad, yeah.
Because it happened so far away, it was the Philippines.
It was the Philippines. We were watching television. Actually, we're in this room that we're sitting right now. And we just got a phone call from one of my other sons. We had four sons. I just knew immediately Benedict was dead. I mean, he just said, hi, Dad, and I just knew immediately. And it was pretty awful. He just came out, very matter of fact. In fact, with hindsight, I was very grateful he just said, Benedict's dead. And that was it, just those three words. And, you know, glad with hindsight, he didn't sort of build it up. Dad, are you all right? I've got some bad news. He's sitting comfortably because he just came out with it. And actually, I was quite lucky because I just went into autopilot as a rabbi who's used to dealing with people who phone up about their mother, father, brother, whatever. But it was enormously painful, obviously. And yeah, it's been just about a year and 2 months now. And it's been fascinating, to be honest with you, because professionally I deal with death all the time. So although I never wanted it to be this way, I've learned a lot about death and grieving and mourning far beyond anything, because once you experience that sort of depth of tragedy, and yes, so hopefully I'm a better rabbi as a result, although I'd never wanted to learn it that way.
But going back to when it happened, was it particularly hard for you to take in because it was so far away?
Yes. I mean, once I got over the autopilot of, oh, well, we need to get this form and that form, yes, there was added difficulties because obviously you wanted to see him and we couldn't. And also being in the Philippines, the other side of the world, they were just so complicated in terms of arrangements. And his widow was there, obviously all alone on the beach with him, and his body got washed up. So it was really, really traumatic.
And how did you get him back to this country? Was that complicated as well?
Yes. Well, it just took a little bit of time. It took 2 weeks for what's called repatriation, which is a horrible word, but actually describes quite accurately what goes on. And it's a matter of a lot of forms and form filling. And also, and here's a tip for anyone, if someone dies aboard, you have to make sure that you get a proper death certificate, because English standards and foreign standards aren't always the same. So for instance, if they just put cause of death, drowning, that would not have been acceptable, and he would not have been allowed back in at Heathrow. And you have to give a much more graphic, I don't know, I forget the medical terms about the lung collapsing and the breath, I mean, horrible stuff. But it was only because I knew that, and we insisted that they get a really full death certificate that he was allowed back into the UK.
But this all sounds horrendous, because you're grieving anyway, and you've got all these additional anxieties.
Yes. Although, in a curious way, having to run around, find funeral directors in the Philippines, try and support our widow, get the forms, liaise, it was quite a good distraction. Because otherwise, what do? Just sit and howl. So at least we had some practical things to get on with.
Did you find your faith a help or a hindrance at the time?
My faith was no help at all. My faith is very, very practical faith. It's about people, it's about community, and it's about camaraderie and the right way of behaving. It didn't actually really impact on his death. I mean, I don't believe in his A Better Place. I think he was in a really good place before he died. I don't believe that God wanted him. I don't believe that I will meet him up in the afterlife, because I'm not sure if there is one. And even if there is one, I'm not sure if he'll be here and I'll be me. So it was no comfort in that sense. And I know for other people, of course, you know, they do have that comfort, and that's great and that's wonderful. For me, it wasn't helpful. I mean, for me, what was helpful was A, doing stuff and the distraction. Community, having a community, and I was really very touched by it. And you can obviously see it's very raw still. I'm very touched by the way that people supported myself and my wife and my other boys. Also, I was very glad I was still working, because, you know, I had to do things at 9 o'clock or 9:30, and just having the busyness, again, the distraction of everyday affairs. Still plenty of time to howl at night, so I wasn't in distraction, I wasn't in denial, but just having to do things, get on with things. In fact, I took a funeral 2 weeks later, somebody else's. I took a week off, just needs to just run around and do things, also to be there for my wife and children. And the other interesting thing was how we all mourned in different ways, and I suppose that's one important lesson that I try and impart to other people, that it's okay to mourn differently, and I've seen actually, particularly in these sort of situations where you lose a child, husband and wife being quite angry with each other for not mourning in the same way. And it's quite okay. You just need to give each other time and space to do it differently.
Can you describe some of the different ways then that your family grieved?
Well, one of them was just, you know, in tears for a week. Another wanted to talk about it. Another one didn't want to talk about it. One of the advantages of being a sort of professional in terms of death is I was able to put into practice some of the stuff I tell other people, which is to try and make the funeral as personal and creative as possible. So it's not just a sort of factory line, you know, we open at page one and on your knees or whatever, but to make it about him in the obvious ways of, you know, the readings we chose and the music and doing things a little bit differently. But something that my sons did was that they decorated his coffin. They got the coffin before he came back to England, so it was empty. So, and they got it a few days beforehand, and they painted it with 64 different images of things that were important to him. Like he played the saxophone, so they painted the saxophone. Like he loved Sudoku, so they did a little Sudoku puzzle. He liked playing Clair de Lune on the piano, so they did the opening bars of Clair de Lune, and dozens of things. So the coffin was totally covered, I won't say tattooed, but it was very colourful. And it was all about him. And then when he came back, we put his body in it. And it was enormously cathartic for them. But it really made, it was not just the standard coffin, it was Benedict's coffin.
I can imagine they'd get a lot of comfort out of doing that for him.
Yeah, and actually, although they were in floods of tears at the time, it was quite fun. It was, you know, the others and their wives helped, and it was like, oh, what should we do here? Or let's put this out there. And it was fun as well as horrendous.
And when it came to the funeral, did you conduct it yourself?
No, I spoke, but I didn't conduct it. It was, part of me wanted it, because he's like, it was my baby, even though it was 34, and I wanted to be the one that sent him off. But it was a wiser thing to let somebody else did it. So I participated and gave one of the eulogies. We also tried something, again, on this idea of making it your funeral. At his stag party, before his wedding, they'd done one of these sort of body surfing things, if you know what I mean, you get carried on, like they do at pop concerts or whatever. And so they had the idea of doing coffin surfing, because we had about, as I say, about 200 or so people there and more. And try to sort of pass his coffin along, and it didn't quite work. We hadn't practiced, but then you can't really practice that sort of thing. But that was just another example of trying to make it, and he would have loved that if he'd known. We would have just thought, oh, that's great, thanks Dad. So
you said earlier on that you'd learned quite a few things that you'd encouraged other people to put into practice. Can you think of any others?
Well, it was, yeah, a couple of things. Gifts. A lot of people brought around cakes or chocolates or flowers, which was nice, but I tell you what was really, really good was someone brought this enormous sack, ginormous sack of tea bags. It was so practical and so useful because we had dozens and dozens of people coming. Another person knitted us a wrap, just a sort of like a blanket wrap, just to snuggle up at night in watching television or just sitting there with a candle. And it was nice because it was, again, it was practical, it was warm, and also a nice feeling because someone had actually made it for us. I also learned, or maybe relearned, what to say and what not to say to people. Not so much at the funeral and afterwards, but maybe a few months afterwards, because we kept on finding people who hadn't known he'd died, and why should they, and who came up to us and said, oh, terribly sorry. And it was often at other events, like I might be at a football match or a cinema. And actually, when people came and said to me, oh, how are you coping? I rather resented it, because actually I wanted to concentrate on the film or the football. I didn't want to be yanked back into grief mode. So it would have been much better if they'd asked a much more neutral question, like, oh, how are things going? In which case I could have said, oh, terrible, I lost my son. Or I could say, oh, I'm really excited at the match and hope we win. You know what I mean? So let the mourner direct the way the ask a question that the mourner can direct it, where the conversation goes. And the other quite annoying thing is when I might give a sort of bland answer, which clearly signaled I didn't want to talk about it, but people would then lean forward and say, yes, but how are you really? And it was sort of kind because they were trying to be helpful, but it just grated. So it's best not to do that sort of thing.
So you're really saying look out for signals
from
the person who's...
That's right. So by all means, say hello, how are you? But then let the person mourning direct the conversation as to whether they want to talk about the bereavement or whether they want to talk about everyday life.
People always say that it's after the funeral that it's almost the worst time because you've done all the practical stuff. You've had the funeral and then people kind of disappeared.
Did yeah, 100%. I always give people a ring when I've done a funeral for someone else, about 2 weeks later, not the next day. Because as I said to that, more or less what you just said to me, it's harder after the funeral because everyone else goes back to normal, except for you. It's not, and the world has changed. And that's when it's really difficult. And yeah.
I read something that you wrote. You said that there was nothing exceptional about what your family was going through, and you realised from your practice as a rabbi that, and because you've taken so many funerals, that there was nothing exceptional, and yet there is something very exceptional when it happens to us, isn't there?
Well, I felt the pain that I hadn't felt before, and that searing pain, but one of the comforts, if you like, was that I didn't suddenly sort of blame the world or blame God or say why me, because it actually happens to a lot of people in all sorts of different ways. And it's, although it's horrible, it's a natural part of life for quite a lot of people. And I actually, afterwards, thinking about that more so, made a list of all the people in the congregation, in my community in Maidenhead, who'd lost sons or daughters in their, as young adults, sort of 25 to 45, and was quite shocked by the number, because I'd known about them individually, but when I actually totted them up, it was much higher than I thought. And, you know, life's pretty risky and life's pretty dangerous. And although we take things for granted, you know, it's I'm often quite amazed at people who get to 70, 80, 90 and successfully. And, you know, we used to think about Victorians and all the child deaths they had and, you know, people would have 10 children and 4 or 5 would survive. But actually, even in our own time, there's a lot of young people who die.
I can't put myself in your shoes. I'm not going to try to. But when you've had a child from tiny, well, from birth, it must make it so much harder to get used to the idea that they're no longer here.
Yes. Yeah. As I said to someone the other day, I felt we'd lost our past, but of course it's again worse for the widow, his wife, who's lost her future. So I'm not sure which is worse. Well, I think it's worse for her, no doubt about it. Actually, much worse for her than for us. Going back to what you said about things that surprised me, another thing was that I sort of assumed before he died that, you know, if anyone in the family died, I'd go and visit their grave and this, that and the other, you know, reasonably regularly. I actually didn't at all. And the only time I visited a grave in that first year was by accident, when I actually did a funeral at the same cemetery. And I thought, oh, Benedict's just a few rows away, I better go and say hello. And what surprised me was that I hadn't had any desire to go to his burial place, because I felt I was just carrying him in my mind or my heart constantly, and therefore going to a muddy little patch didn't make any difference because he was with me. He wasn't over there.
So do you think about him all the time?
Not as much, but certainly for the opening months, it was every 10 minutes, every 15 minutes. And I just sort of thought about him and sort of allowed myself 10 or 15 seconds and then moved on to whatever I was doing, a conversation I was part of or an article I was writing or whatever it was. But yeah, it was with me constantly. And I also noticed that what I was thinking shifted. In the first 2 or 3 months, I was really just thinking about the moment of his death and how horrible it must have been for him. Hopefully, he lost consciousness quickly. And it was just that moment of death. Since then, I've sort of thought much more about him as a person and things we used to do together.
I don't know enough about the Jewish faith to know how you're supposed to mark somebody's death and what the rituals are involved, but were they helpful to you?
Yes, I mean, Judaism actually does death quite well. There's some things we don't do well, but we do death well. There's a very formalized structure, but which is actually very helpful at the time, because all you really want is the person coming back. And it gives a structure for mourning which sort of holds you. So Jewish funerals tend to be quite quick, usually within the first 3 or 4 days. Obviously it couldn't be with Benedict, he had to be repatriated. But the idea being that, well, you know, you partly to honour the person by not leaving their body around, and even though it's looked after in the mortuary, of course, and also partly for you to start the grieving process, because there's a sort of limbo period, isn't there, between hearing the news and actually the funeral. So usually about 3 or 4 days, then there's a funeral, and then there's what's called the shiva, which is a Hebrew word for seven, and 7 days of mourning, where you, if you want, that is, stay at home and people come and visit. And you just stay at home and literally people will pop in morning, afternoon, evening, and they will talk about this or that, and maybe about the personal, maybe about politics, and you have a chance to get it out of your system. So, oh, if only this, or if only that, or should I have called the ambulance, or I should have noticed he wasn't taking the pills, or just saying it over and over again, and it can be quite a cathartic process.
Did you have that then? Did you have open house here?
Yeah, we had a lot of people here, and we didn't do it for the full 7 days, in fact, because we felt the 3 days was enough. And also, it was actually quite hard for me, to be honest with you, because normally I'm the one doing the comforting. It was quite hard to go and roll reverse and be the comforter. And I found that sort of uncomfortable. Not that I wasn't appreciative of everyone's kindness. And then you have the first month where you don't do certain things, like you go to the cinema or entertainment. And then there's the first year when you say memorial prayers every week. And then on the anniversary of the year, and the anniversary of the death, you always light a candle. So you've got this very intense 7 days, then the 30 days, then the year, then the annual. It's like a sort of staircase escalator from the depths of grief up back up into everyday life. And it's actually quite effective and quite useful, and you do feel held. And it also means you know what to do. And even if you buck against the rules, you know what the rules are. So it gives you that structure if you need it.
And I can see now why the tea bags were so useful.
Yes, that's right, exactly right.
So you had loads of people here for 3 days.
Yes, and well wishes for months and months. And I'm still getting people writing to me or coming up to me and saying, oh, I just heard the news and so forth.
One of the other things I read that you'd said somewhere was that when people are in the depth of grief and feeling beyond comfort, that nothing much can help them, you can try and reassure them that they will eventually re-enter the stream of life. I thought that was a lovely phrase.
Yes, I mean, the truth is that the time is a great healer. And I know it's a cliche, but it's only a cliche because it's true. I try not to tell that to people when they are in that depth of grief, because they can't hear it, and they can't think of their grief being assuaged in any way. But it does, and you get used to the absence. Most people get used to the absence. There are some people who just stay in that grief mode, either because they can't get out of it, or because sometimes they want to stay in it, because it's almost like a comfort blanket, and it's more dangerous to leave the "I am a grieving widow" or whatever, and try and carve out a new path and make those changes and make new relationships. But yeah, I mean, and I learned that a long time ago. I just remember seeing, we had a dinner in the community, and there was about 20 or 30 people there, and I noticed one couple laughing and drinking and enjoying themselves, just like, you know, why shouldn't they? And I suddenly thought, oh, how strange, because 5 years ago, their son had jumped off a university building, a block of flats, and been killed, suicide. And they were devastated, and they thought the sun would never shine again. And of course, 5 years later it is, and they're laughing and joking. Not to say that after dinner they might not have thought about him, but, you know, there they were out in the social evening, because time does heal, or can heal, certainly.
Initially, that can be quite hard, can't it? When you first find yourself thinking that you may be enjoying life again, you can feel a bit guilty. Should I be doing this? Should I be feeling like this?
I remember the first time my wife and I sort of went out to the cinema, and didn't talk about Benedict for 3 hours. We felt, oh, we haven't mentioned him. And actually, guilt's a strange thing. I mean, I felt very guilty when he died. Now, I wasn't, it was the other side of the world, the Philippines. You know, I had nothing to do with his death, but I still felt guilty because I'm his father. And
you looked after him all his life.
Yeah, I should have been there to protect him. Now, that's totally irrational, totally illogical. But that's what I feel. And feelings and logic are completely worlds apart.
But there's often a lot of guilt involved after a death, isn't there? We often say, what could I have done? What should I have done? What didn't I do? We're often left with regrets. And I guess you've seen that in your parishioners.
Yes. And to be honest, sometimes it's justified. Sometimes the wife, the husband, the son, the daughter didn't do what they should have done. They didn't call the ambulance or whatever. But most times it's not at all justified. And a heart attack would have happened anyway, or the stroke, or there's so much in life that is beyond our control, and we think we're in control, but often we're not.
So is there anything you particularly say to people who've just been bereaved?
Two things really. First is not to move house immediately. A lot of people are saying, this house is too big for me or whatever. Yes, they may have to move, but I wouldn't do it probably for a year if that's financially okay to stay where they are, because otherwise it's you lose your neighbours and the postman and the milkman or the local shops or whatever. It's almost like going to a strange place, so it's almost like a double bereavement. So settle your emotions first in the place that you feel reasonably at home in, and only then think of moving rather than rushing off elsewhere. And the other piece of advice if people ask you out for a coffee, a lunch, a dinner, whatever, always accept, even if you feel terrible and never want to, because it gets you out of the house. Otherwise, you just stay at home. And also, if you do that and then they'll invite you another time where you'll reciprocate, but if you say no, then the invitations dry up and suddenly all that goodwill dissipates. So there's plenty of time to howl when you come home, but accept those invitations. It's good for you. It's good for you to get out and talk to other people.
Can you remember back to the days around the funeral, after the funeral, when you had to kind of tell yourself, right, I've got to get on with my life now?
Well, it may seem odd but to say, but we were relatively lucky in that Benedict's death has not really altered our lives, the course of our lives. I mean, it's on a personal level, it's been horrendous. On an emotional level, it's been deeply, deeply painful. But I'm still doing the job I'm doing. We haven't had to think about selling house or moving or what we were going to do when eventually we retire. So it hasn't really affected any major decisions. I mean, it's affected day-to-day life and how we feel. But no, whereas, and we're still reasonably fit and healthy, whereas there are, of course, people, and I've seen a lot of it, where particularly where it's an elderly couple and one of them passes away, or even in a younger couple and one of them passes away, I suppose, where they've had to sort of, at one point, look in the mirror and say, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And actually, if you were interviewing Benedict's widow, I still think of her as the wife because she's only in her 30s and seems too young to have the word widow, but, you know, you can be widowed young. Of course you can. She would say it dramatically altered her life because she actually had stopped her job because she was going to start a new job. She couldn't go back to work after his death. She's been a complete wreck, frankly. They were going to start a family. She's now, well, unless she meets someone fairly soon, which I think she won't because she's not in the emotional state, she may end up being childless as a result. So for her, it's had devastating impact. And we've tried to help her and support her, but it's been really difficult for her. There will come a point, I hope, where she just is ready to move on, but she's not, and it's taken a long time.
But as you said earlier, it's the loss of her future, isn't it? Yes. The loss of her hopes and dreams for him and for them, both.
The only thing that's just a small practical example is at some point I'm going to retire, and we were thinking of going down to Brighton and live there. But he died in the sea, and I don't want to be seeing the sea every day and the reminder of that. So we're not going to Brighton now. So that's the only practical change it's made, apart from the concert sadness.
I can imagine that's a big deal for you.
Yes, we've had to think of where else we're going to go because it ticked all sorts of boxes, but that's a small price.
Rabbi Jonathan Romain, thank you so much for talking to me. We'll be having more chats in future episodes about everything to do with death and dying, such as how to prepare for it, what it's really like when someone dies, how to talk about it, what kind of plans to make, how different cultures and faiths approach dying and bereavement, lots more around grief and loss, how to support others in their sadness, and my personal hobby horse, how to rebuild a life, a good life, after the loss of someone special. If you'd like to join us to talk about the death of someone near to you, if this episode has resonated with you and you have a story to share, or if you've been affected by some of the issues raised, please do get in touch at hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.